I wonder, is what's happening right now, our Selma, is it a new generation's Selma, the organizing and the action that is taking place? And I wanted to share with you that this morning was not easy for me. Preparing for this worship was difficult. I grew up in a racially divided city in Shreveport, Louisiana, and I felt called to the ministry because I wanted to do racial work. I've been in seminary for 4 years, and I've taken many classes, what ARAO classes, what Unitarian Universalists, they love their acronyms, but it's anti-racism, anti-oppression work. It's actually embedded in the curriculum at my seminary, Meadville Lombard, and yet it is still difficult to talk about. Why is it so hard for white people to talk about race? I don't know, but we're going to do it. We're going to talk about racism, this power and privilege and prejudice, which is what racism is. Selma took place 10 years before I was born, and I know many of you here today remember those tumultuous times in our nation's history. But what is happening now? What has been happening since the grand jury announced that the police officer who shot unarmed teen Michael Brown would not be brought to trial is a continuing chapter in this fight for racial justice, this fight against racism. So this morning, I'm going to share with you a little bit of my upbringing, my experience of racism, and I will share with you what Unitarian Universalists are doing today, what we can do to answer the call to be allies. When I was 12 years old, I attended a magnet school, a magnet middle school, art school, that was located in a predominantly black neighborhood, Cedar Grove. And so many of my classmates were from the neighborhood around the school, and then there were kids, white kids like me, that lived in other neighborhoods that attended the school. In late September of 1988, our school was closed for 2 days because the area around it had become a crime scene. Tamalo Virgo was a young white woman who went into a park in the neighborhood to buy crack cocaine, and the young man that she was trying to purchase the cocaine from actually took her money and did not provide her with the crack cocaine. Mark Boulding was a resident of the neighborhood and remembers that night. He writes, "She returned to the park that evening, parked her car, and walked towards the edge of the park, and she had a gun, and she fired it into a group of young men that was just hanging out, killing David McKinney, just an innocent bystander. Virgo made her way back to the car, but the car stalled. She and her companion took refuge in a convenience store and explained what had just happened to its white owner, who called the police, and he emptied the store of everyone except for Virgo and her accomplice. By the time the police arrived, the crowd was ready, more ready than usual. On this particular day, the badges of the police meant nothing. Their threats seemed more hollow than usual, and the names they called us, we were numb to by now. Only the sight of David McKinney lying dead in the grass had the attention of the crowd. As the three boarded the van, a shout came from the crowd directed at the store owner, 'You've robbed us long enough, and you have got to go.' With that, the first brick was hurled through the window of the store, and there we were, the voice of the law against the scream for justice. Two stores were burnt down in a course of 2 days of violence in Cedar Grove, and it's reported that stones were thrown at white people who passed in their cars. So once the school opened again and my mom drove me to school, I saw the ashes of the buildings that had burned down. I saw the scars of the violence. And the only narrative that I remember hearing is that the black people had burned down their neighborhood. I knew it was race-related, but I didn't know the depth of it. I didn't know the history of the oppression in my hometown. I was only 12. But I knew the anger, and I knew that the nastiness that I was hearing from white people about black people just didn't feel right. At this point, I'm just going to put this out there. I know that my sermons are recorded, and there's a good chance that my parents will listen to this sermon. And this topic that I'm discussing is delicate and messy and uncomfortable, but they raised me, bless their hearts, to speak truth to power. So I'm going to continue, knowing that they will probably listen to this, because this next part is difficult for me to share. Not long after this event, an artist drew a map of Shreveport. It was a cultural map. I remember seeing it. It's like a cartoon map, and it showed the Red River, and it showed Southern Made Donut Shop, and it showed Strawn's Diner, which has the best strawberry pie you will ever put in your mouth. So good. It showed the Ferris Wheel at Hamels Park, which was a local amusement park in Derry. And it showed my neighborhood. My neighborhood was on the map, and it was illustrated by cotton, because I lived in a neighborhood that had cotton fields all around it. We used to play in the cotton fields when I was a child. And this is the really hard part. It showed residents of Cedar Grove as roaches being sprayed by a white hand bearing a can of insecticide. And the neighborhood is depicted on the map by a gorilla. So have you ever heard when one fish asks another fish, how's the water? And the other fish replies, what's water? I believe that what happened in Cedar Grove and seeing that map made me very aware of the water. There is an active, organized, growing racial justice movement in the United States right now. And the movement isn't new, but it has been recatalyzed. People all over the country who were silent 6 months ago are saying no more. There have been vigils and marches, rallies, nonviolent demonstrations, disruptions of commerce, like the Mall of America protest y'all might have seen. That was organized by young black organizers, and many of them Unitarian Universalists. I think there were 3,000 people that closed down the Mall of America on that day, which I think is pretty awesome. There have been disruptions of traffic, the taking of streets, disruptions of campus life, actions at police stations, at city halls, state capitals, federal buildings. Just this week, the protesters interrupted lunch at a Capitol Hill cafeteria holding a die-in in honor of Michael Brown. About 50 protesters, including Unitarian Universalist ministers, congregated in the U.S. House of Representatives office cafeteria, chanting Black Lives Matter. And they stayed on the floor in front of the cafeteria for about 4.5 minutes to represent the 4.5 hours that Michael Brown's body lied in the street after he was shot. The movement has a name, as I mentioned, that many have been using, a hashtag, if you're familiar with Twitter, Black Lives Matter. According to the creator of the Black Lives Matter campaign, it is a response to the anti-black racism that permeates our society and also, unfortunately, our movements. Black Lives Matter is an ideological and political intervention in a world where black lives are systematically and intentionally targeted for demise. It is an affirmation of black folks' contributions to this society, their humanity and resilience in the face of deadly oppression. When we say Black Lives Matter, we are talking about all the ways in which black people are deprived of basic human rights and dignity. When I was 15 and a freshman at Captain Shreve High School in Shreveport, I became the first and only member of the Black Studies Association. Most of the members of the Black Studies Association welcomed my participation in the club, though not everyone was happy, as you can imagine. A lot of white people weren't happy about it. And there were several black students who were not thrilled with me either because they felt I was encroaching upon their space and their identity. And looking back, I can totally see where they were coming from. There weren't a lot of non-white spaces for them to be. But I didn't claim it as something that was not mine. I did it to stand in solidarity with the students who were being oppressed in my hometown. I didn't know it then, but that act of solidarity is what we call being an ally now. There is very little black history that was taught in my high school, so the Black Studies Association taught black history. It gave the group, the student leaders, a place to be leaders, to support one another, and to celebrate their culture. And I did not take on any leadership, which was hard for me. I just bore witness to the experiences of the others, and I listened And I cried out of frustration as I learned on a deeper level what it means to be a black person in the South. And I was taught the black national anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. And we sang it at every meeting. And I felt so honored to learn this song. And every time I hear it now, and we're going to sing it as our closing hymn today, it is very special to me. I realized that the only way I was going to know what it is like was through listening to those who lived it. And not only being empathetic, but also being an ally by standing up in solidarity. As Joe Lowndes, author of From the New Deal to the New Right, Race and the Southern Origins of Modern Conservatism, has said, a lot of white liberals talk about empathy when what they really need to talk about is solidarity. Don't let empathy be the end point of the conversation. How does our empathetic response to these events fuel the setting down of our power and the lifting up of those who are powerless? The setting down of our own power and the lifting up of those who are powerless. So what does this look like? What does it mean to be a white ally? So I was going to tell you, but then I found this video of a video blogger, Francesca Ramsey, and she does it really well, and she's quite funny. And so she's going to tell us five ways in which we can be an ally.